This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you so much. I want to begin by acknowledging that a season that I was able to open with Isabel Allende and to close with Eduardo Galeano is quite a season indeed, and I'm very honored to have been asked. I also want you to notice that I'm missing a button. So far, four people have noticed, and I thought everyone will notice. And the only way to do this is to acknowledge it, yes? Thank you. My mother would be so ashamed. I was reading a book recently about speaking in public, and they say that you should say funny things and also say something wonderful about the host and about the other guests. And I am going to say funny things, but I want to begin by saying something wonderful about the host and the guest. Very recently, just in the last several months, Hugo Chavez gave a copy of Open Veins of Latin America to Obama Baraka. precipitating a rise to the top of the bestseller list, reaching number two on Amazon, I am very proud to know that Eduardo Galeano, when told, you are a bestseller, he said, I am not available for sale. This is the right kind of person. But before all of this ever, the Lannan Foundation had chosen Eduardo Galeano as the first recipient of their Cultural Freedom Prize. And I'm very proud to be associated with an organization, a foundation, that doesn't have to be told what's important with news coming from everywhere in the world. We all knew how important Eduardo Galeano is. Now, Eduardo Galeano seems never not to have been Eduardo Galeano. When he was a young man in school, told by the teacher that this or that European explorer was the first man to see two oceans from the same piece of land at the same time, Galeano raised his hand and said, what, were the indigenous people blind? This was the first of his exiles. He was expelled from the classroom. Education seems not to have had a profound effect on him. His singularity was always primary. He was always interested in saying the things that people didn't say. In fact, he is the person who detects in language, in several languages, those Eurocentric and Norte Americano attitudes that conceal the truth. And he is a great discerner, a burrower under the commonly said thing to find its truth. After Open Veins of Latin America, he decided that jail, where he was placed, was not a healthy place to be. So he was exiled in Argentina, where he edited newspapers and magazines. One of the most beautiful acts of what we will call Galeanismo is that he was the editor of a literary cultural magazine called Crisis. And what does he do? Well, you know, what do you do when you're an editor of a literary cultural magazine most of the time? You get the most prestigious names you can to be on the cover of the magazine. No. Not Eduardo Galeano. An act of Galeanismo is to say, we will talk to people in the street and ask them what they have been dreaming, and we will print that. Literature comes from everywhere, And it comes from the day mind as well as the night mind, from the famous and the infamous, from the high and the lonely. There is no longer any need for these hysterical differentiations. We want to live in a world without borders. We want to force no one into exile, cultural or otherwise. His magnificence continues with a three-volume work called Memories of Fire, an extraordinary history of the North and South American continents that tells us the story not only of the gods, but of the conquerors, of the peasants, of everyone. And, you know, I have to confess that when you read these three books, you come out staggering, both with the amazement at the quality of the writing, its enormous originality, originality of genre, something he invented himself. His units are very brief. Each section is 5, 6, 7 paragraphs. Dream is treated in the same tone of voice as Chronicle. He has an exquisite ear for the non-essential. So when you read him, you feel, remember when we used to talk when we were young about a pill we hoped we could take at night so that we could pass the test the next morning without having to read the books? Each of these is a tiny pill that swells, it opens and expands. If you want to know more, you can add the water, which is to do the research, but he will contract and compress until the material is absolutely essentialist. In fact, I've come to call him an essentialist Marxist sensualist. Then, you see, I didn't understand this at first. This is when I first met Eduardo Galeano. After those books, I met him when the Book of Embraces came out. And it was such a tender and sweet book. And I thought, what is this coming from the author of Memories of Fire? And then subsequent books, Upside Down, Voices of Time, had more of the whimsical about them. And I have to be honest, worried, because I thought this man's great gift is the reading into history and to create the sense of the ownership of history by the devastated. If we lose the wars, we will at least own the history of the deprivations that have been suffered. This is an extraordinary gift that Galeano gives back to the dispossessed. So then, finally, this year, I got a galley of the new book, Mirrors, in Spanish, Espejos. And I was so thrilled. This is the book, I believe, that we've been waiting for from Galeano since Memories of Fire. Not only that, like a true heir of Cervantes, he does the quixotically impossible. This book, in 300 brief stories, is a history of all mankind from the dawn of time. He did it because it was impossible. Doing the impossible is what we require of great literature, not just what we want. It's how we know that we are reading great literature. It seems to us to be impossible even as we read it. I want to welcome Eduardo Galeano, the Magnificent.
Thank you, Michael, for all these generous calumnies. And thank you all of you, for coming here. And of course, the Lanham people, Lanham Foundation people, who made it possible. I'm going to to read some stories from this most recent book, not the last one, I hope, called Mirrors. And before, I want to dedicate the reading. Being a book about missing people, I want to dedicate to a missing founding father of this nation. Before writing it, I made a sort of a survey or test between all my U.S. friends, asking them if they had ever heard about a founding father called Robert Carter. And none of them had, so I decided to write the story, which is this one. Robert Carter was buried in the garden. In his will, he asked to be laid under a shady tree where he might be undisturbed and sleep in peace and obscurity. No stone, nor inscription. This Virginia patrician was one of the richest, if not the richest, of all the prosperous landowners who broke ties with England. Although several other founding fathers looked askance at slavery, none of them freed their slaves. Carter was the only one to unchain the 450 blacks he owned to allow them to live and work according to their own will and pleasure. He freed them 70 years before Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, and he did so gradually, taking care that none was simply turned out and deserted. Such folly condemned him to solitude and oblivion. He was cut off by his friends, his neighbors, and his family, all of whom were convinced that free blacks were a threat to personal and national security. And later on, his acts were rewarded with collective amnesia. So, to Robert Carter. Beginning with the title of the book, Mirrors, I'll explain it in a very easy way. The great Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges hated sex because sex multiplies people. And he also hated mirrors because mirrors multiply people. That's exactly the reason. Well, about sex I don't have yet an opinion, but that's exactly the reason why I love mirrors, because they multiply people. And inside this book called People, there are a lot of unknown, invisible men and women, like, for instance, Robert Carter. And this explains also the cover of the book. Some friends of mine have wondered why did I choose this image for the cover of my book, and where does this beauty come from? I'll tell you. West African sculptures have always sung while they worked, and they do not stop singing until their sculptures are finished. That way the music gets inside the carvings and keeps on singing. In 1910, Leo Frobenius found ancient sculptures on the slave coast that made his eyes bulge. Their beauty was such that the German explorer believed they were Greek, brought from Athens, or perhaps from the lost Atlantis. His colleagues agreed, Africa, daughter of a scorn, mother of a slave, could not have produced such marvels. It did, though. Those music-filled effigies had been sculpted a few centuries previous in the belly bottom of the world, in Ife, the sacred place where the Yoruba gods gave birth to women and men. Africa turned out to be an unending wellspring of art worth celebrating and worth stealing. It seems Paul Gauguin, a rather absent-minded fellow, put his name on a couple of sculptures from the Congo, and the error was contagious. From then on, Picasso, Modigliani, Klee, Giacometti, Ernst Mohr, and many other European artists made the same mistake and did so with alarming frequency. Pillaged by its colonial masters, Africa would never know how responsible it was for the most astonishing achievements in 20th century European art. There is a short story at the beginning of the book, one of the first stories, that I think may be a good synthesis of what I was trying to do, working so hard in recovering so many people. How would the Trojan War have been told by an unknown soldier, a Greek foot soldier ignored by the gods and desired only by the vultures that circle the battlefields, a farmer fighter, hymned by no one, sculpted by no one, a nobody, and everybody, obliged to kill, and without the slightest interest in being killed to win Helen's eyes? Would that soldier have predicted what Euripides later confirmed, that Helen never was in Troy? Never. Only her shadow? That 10 years of butchery occurred for the sake of an empty tunic? And if that soldier survived, what would he recall? Who knows? Maybe the smell of pain, and only that. 3,000 years after the fall of Troy, war correspondents Robert Fisk and Fran Sevilla tell us that wars stink. They have been in several wars, both of them on the inside, and they know the hot, sweet, sticky stench of decay that gets into your pores and takes up residence in your body, the nausea that never goes away. Speaking about the invisibles. There they are, painted on the walls and roofs of caves. Bison, elk, bears, horses, eagles, women, men. These figures are ageless. They were born thousands upon thousands of years ago, but they are born anew every time someone looks at them. How could he, our ancestor of long ago, paint so delicately How could a brute who fought wild beasts with his bare hands create images so filled with grace? How did he manage to draw those flying lines that break free of the stone and take to the earth? How could he? Or was it she? This is strange because I have read so many books about the so-called prehistoric art, and this question never appeared. I don't know why. Perhaps because women are a minority, but I'm not strong in mathematics, but how can half of humanity be a minority? I don't know. It's one of the mysteries I will never be able to solve, like this enigmatic name of the Secretary of War and the war budget in the United States, which are called Secretary of Defense and Defense budget. Defense against who? Last time this country was invaded was in 1812. But this country has invaded almost all countries in the world. Why it should be defense budget? God knows. The symbols of the French Revolution are female, women of marble or bronze with powerful naked breasts, Frisian caps, flags aflutter. But what the revolution produced was the declaration of the rights of man and the citizen. And when revolutionary militant Olympe de Gouges proposed a declaration of the rights of woman and the female citizen, she was hauled off to jail. A revolutionary tribunal found her guilty, and the guillotine removed her head. At the foot of the scaffold, Olympe asked, "If we women have the right, if we women have the right to go to the guillotine, should we not also have the right to go to the tribune?" Not allowed. They could not speak, they could not vote. The convention, the Revolutionary Congress, closed down all women's political associations and forbade women from debating men as equals. Olympe de Gouges' companions were sent to the lunatic asylum, and soon after her execution, it was the turn of Manon Holland. Manon was the wife of a minister of the government, but not even that could save her. She was found guilty of, quote, "an antinatural tendency to political activism." End of the quote. She had betrayed her feminine nature, which was to keep house and give birth to brave sons. And she had committed the deadly offense of sticking her nose into the masculine affairs of the state. And the guillotine dropped once more. I have some evil friends. It would be better to have enemies than evil friends. So when I published Mirrors is full of stories about the long history of women's discrimination and women's humiliation. And so my beloved evil friends asked me, and so the system, the owners of power, in their infinite perversity, gave you a gift called Condoleezza Rice. And I could say nothing. Perhaps I'm looking for an answer, but others disappeared. Thousands of unburied dead wander the Argentinian Pampa. They are the disappeared from the last military dictatorship. General Jorge Videla and his henchmen used disappearance as a weapon of war on a scale never before seen. He used it, but he did not invent it. A century beforehand, against Argentina's native peoples, General Julio Argentino Roca employed the same masterpiece of cruelty, which obliged each victim to die and die again and go on dying, while his loved ones lose their minds chasing his elusive shadow. In Argentina, as in all the Americas, the Indians were the first disappeared. They disappeared before they even appeared. General Roca called his invasion of Indian lands the conquest of the desert. Patagonia was an empty space, a kingdom of nothing, inhabited by no one. After that, Indians continued disappearing. Those who surrounded and gave up their land and everything else were called indios reducidos, reduced to the point of disappearing. And those who did not surrender and were defeated by gunfire or swords, blows, disappeared into numbers, becoming the nameless dead of military body counts. And their children disappeared too, divided up as war booty, called by other names, emptied of memory. They became little slaves for the murderers of their parents. Adam and Eve were black. The human voyage in the world began in Africa. From there, our ancestors set out to conquer the planet. Many, many paths led them to many destinies, and the sun took care of handing out colors from the palette. Now the rainbow of the earth is more colorful than the rainbow of the sky, but we all are immigrants from Africa. Even the whitest of whites comes from Africa. Maybe we refuse to concede our common origin because racism causes amnesia, or because we find it unbelievable that in those days long past, the entire world was our kingdom, an immense map without borders, and our legs were the only passport required. At the height of a wave of lynchings, D.W. Griffiths, there is a problem with the sound, or it's a storm outside, or perhaps it can be arranged, I don't know. But I swear it's not me. I have no drum here. At the height of a wave of lynchings, D.W. Griffiths, again, at the height of a wave of lynchings, D.W. Griffith's film, It's Destiny. D.W. Griffith's film, The Birth of a Nation, sings a hymn of praise to the Ku Klux Klan. This is Hollywood's first blockbuster and the greatest box office success ever for a silent movie. It is also the first film that ever opened at the White House. President Woodrow Wilson gives it a standing ovation, Applauding it, he applauds himself. Wilson, the famous flag bearer of freedom, wrote most of the texts that accompany the epic images. The president's words explain that the emancipation of the slaves was, quote, a veritable overthrow of civilization in the South, the white South under the heel of the black South, end quote. Ever since, chaos reigns because blacks are, quote, men who knew none of the uses of authority except its insolences, end quote. But President Wilson lights the lamp of hope, quote, at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, end quote. And even Jesus himself comes down from heaven at the end of the movie to give his blessing. Well, fortunately, the U.S. has a quite different president nowadays. Brunete, Spain, 1937. Oliver Law is black and red and a working man. He left Chicago to fight for the Spanish Republic in the ranks of the Lincoln Brigade. In the brigade, blacks do not form a separate regiment. For the first time in the history of the United States, whites and blacks mix. And for the first time in the history of the United States, white soldiers obey the orders of a black commanding officer. An unusual commander. When Oliver Law gives the order to attack, he does not watch his men through binoculars. He is the first to join the fight. But then all the volunteers in the international brigades are unusual. They do not fight to win medals or conquer land or capture oil wells. Sometimes Oliver wonders, since this Spanish war is a war between whites, who for centuries have held us in slavery, why am I a Negro? Why am I here? And he himself answers, we came to wipe out the fascists. And laughing, he adds, as if it were a joke, some of us must die doing the job. In the Battle of Brunete, summer of 1937, Oliver Law takes a bullet in the breast. Another story coming from Spain, one year before this military coup of Franco, there were elections in Spain, and this is a true story, as all of the other stories. It happened in the outskirts of Sevilla, winter of 1936, when the Spanish elections were imminent. A gentleman is riding about his lands when a man in tatters crosses his path. Without getting off his horse, the gentleman calls him over and puts in his hand a coin and a list of candidates. The man lets them fall, coin and list. And turning his back, he says, "In my hunger, I am in charge. En mi hambre, mando yo." A homage to my masters, Mark Twain and Ambrose Bierce. Some months after invading Iraq, President George W. Bush said his mother had been the War of Philippines. Both wars were inspired from heaven. Bush disclosed that God had ordered him to act as he did. He didn't disclose if it was by mail, fax, phone. And a century beforehand, President William McKinley also heard the voice from the great beyond. "God told me," he said, "that we could not leave the Filipinos to themselves. They were unfit for self-government. There was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate them and uplift and civilize and Christianize them." Well, thus the Philippines were liberated from the Filipino threat. And the Filipino threat, yes. And along the way, the United States also saved Cuba, Puerto Rico, Honduras, Colombia, Panama, Dominican Republic, Hawaii, Guam, Samoa, and other places. At the time, writer Ambrose Bierce revealed, "War is God's way of teaching us geography." And his colleague Mark Twain, leader of the Anti-Imperialist League, designed a new flag for the nation, featuring little skulls in place of stars. General Frederick Funston suggested Twain ought to be hanged for treason. But Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn defended their father. Speaking of fathers, I'm a handwriter. I mean, I write by hand, but later, after the first versions, I begin using computers. A computer now. I changed my opinion about it, and now I understood it's a very good tool, very useful. As soon as I don't become the machine of my machine, of course, I don't become the tool of my tool. But it is quite useful. I had prejudices against computers. I was almost sure that they drank at night when nobody was watching. They were drinking whiskey, rum, tequila, wine, everything. And that was the explanation I found, no? I don't know, of the weird things they do during the day, hours. But the fact is, I now I'm using a computer, and I think I should begin. And everybody else should begin the day work when they turn on the computer, saying thank you to the father of the computers, who was Alan Turing. And of course, this is one of the stories included in the book about sexual diversity, because the book mirrors is a homage to human diversity. And sexual diversity is a very important part of human diversity. Working for British intelligence, Alan Turing helped shorten the Second World War when he invented a machine that could crack the impenetrably military codes used by Germany's high command. At that point, he had already dreamed up a prototype for an electronic computer that had laid out the theoretical basis for today's information systems. And later on, he led the team that built the first computer to operate with integrated programs. He played interminable chess games with it and asked it questions that drove it nuts. And he insisted that it should write him love letters. The machine responded by emitting messages, rather incoherent. But it was not a machine. It was not at all a machine. No. It was flesh and blood, Manchester police, who arrested him in 1952 for gross indecency. At the trial, Turing pled guilty to being a homosexual. To be set free, he agreed to undergo medical treatment to cure him of the affliction. The bombardment of drugs left him impotent. He grew breasts. He stayed indoors, no longer went to the university. He heard murmurs, felt stirs drilling into his back. He had the habit of eating an apple before going to bed. And one night, he injected cyanide into the apple he was about to eat. El amor que pasa, la vida que pesa, la muerte que pisa. Hay dolores inevitables, y así es nomás y ni modo. Pero las autoridades planetarias agregan dolor al dolor y encima nos cobran ese favor que nos hacen. En dinero contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al valor agregado y en desdicha contante y sonante pagamos cada día el impuesto al dolor agregado. El dolor agregado se disfraza de fatalidad del destino, como si fueran la misma cosa, la angustia que nace de la fugacidad de la vida y la angustia que nace de la fugacidad del empleo. Love wanes, life wastes, death wastes. Some griefs are inevitable. That's the way it is, and not much can be done about it. But those in charge of the planet pile grief on top of grief and then charge us for the favor. We pay the value-added tax every day in cold, hard cash, and every day in cold, hard misfortune, we pay the grief-added tax. The added sorrow comes disguised as fate or destiny, as if the anguish born of the fleeting life were the same as the anguish born of the fleeting jobs. Something about the symbol of our time, the wall. The Berlin Wall was on the news every day. From morning till night, we read, saw, heard the wall of shame, the wall of infamy, the iron curtain. In the end, this wall, which deserved to fall, fell. But other walls sprouted and continue sprouting across the world. Even though they are much larger than the one in Berlin, we hear little or nothing about them. Little is said about the wall the United States is building along the Mexican border, and little is said about the barbed wire barriers in the Spanish enclaves in the African coast. Practically nothing is said about the West Bank Wall, which perpetuates the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands and will be 15 times longer than the Berlin Wall. And nothing, but nothing at all is said about the Morocco Wall, which perpetuates the seizure of the Saharan homeland by the Kingdom of Morocco and is 60 times the length of the Berlin Wall. Why are some walls so loud and others mute? I'm finishing, almost finishing. Tomorrow I have Los Angeles, and the day after tomorrow, Berkeley. But it's the last part of a long tour, full of airports. And it has been quite an experience for me. I don't know if sometimes inspiration, it's a strange woman inspiration, doesn't come and help me. Perhaps I may become a stripper because I have done so many strip teases in these days. Receiving orders and orders, shouting, people terrible, and obliging me to get naked. And so airports are really difficult places nowadays. I don't know if it's related to the legalization of torture, but it seems to be, they seem to be torture chambers. Legal torture chambers. Thanks to Bush and so on. This little story has something to do with it. Sleeping, she saw us. Elena dreamed we were waiting in line at an airport. A long line, where every passenger had under the arm the pillow on which he or she had slept the night before. The pillows were sent through a dream-reading machine. The machine detected any dangerous dreams that threatened to disturb the peace. The 20th century was born proclaiming peace and justice, but it died bathed in blood and passed on a world much more unjust than the one it inherited. The 21st century, which also arrived heralding peace and justice, is following in its predecessor's footsteps. In my childhood, I was convinced that everything that went astray on Earth ended up on the Moon. But the astronauts found no sign of dangerous dreams or broken promises or hopes betrayed. If not on the Moon, where might they be? Perhaps they were never misplaced. Perhaps they are in hiding here on Earth, waiting, esperando nos, a nosotros, los humanitos. Darwin told us we are cousins of the apes, not the angels. And later on we learned we emerged from Africa's jungle and no stork ever carried us from Paris. And not long ago we discovered that our genes are almost identical to those of mice. Now we can't tell if we are God's masterpiece or the devil's bad joke. We puny humans, exterminators of everything, hunters of our own, creators of the atom bomb, the hydrogen bomb, and the neutron bomb, which is the healthiest of all bombs since it vaporizes people and leaves objects intact. We, the only animals who invent machines. The only ones who live at the service of the machines they invent. The only ones who devour their own home. The only ones who poison the water they drink and the earth that feeds them. The only ones capable of renting or selling themselves, or renting or selling their fellow humans. The only ones who kill for fun. The only ones who torture. The only ones who rape. And also. And also. The only ones who laugh. The only ones who daydream. The only ones who make silk from the spit of a worm. The ones who find beauty in rubbish. The ones who discover colors beyond the rainbow. The ones who nourish the voices of the world with new music and who create words so that neither reality nor memory will be mute. Y también. Los únicos que ríen, los únicos que sueñan despiertos, los que hacen seda de la baba del gusano, los que convierten la basura en hermosura, los que descubren colores que el arco iris no conoce, los que dan nuevas músicas a las voces del mundo y crean palabras para que no sean mudas la realidad ni su memoria. Thanks.
Concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I want to guarantee you all that I've read and heard all of the interviews that Eduardo Galeano has given about mirrors, and I promise I will not ask any questions that I've heard him ask before. Because people have a tendency to ask him the same questions all the time, but would you believe that with a book as remarkably diverse as this one, Mirrors, that not one person has spoken to him or asked him about the extraordinary breadth of the research for this book? As if somehow or other a writer were a machine who knows things that other people do not know, and no one wants to know how they find out, which is what we all do want to know. How do we learn what we do not know? How do we learn what has been kept from us? Yeah? So even tonight, I did not know that Woodrow Wilson had written the racist texts that accompany Birth of a Nation? No idea. I did not know that Mark Twain belonged to an anti-imperialist league and designed a flag with small skulls instead of stars. Tell us about the research for this book, please. It's in his pocket.
It's here. The research. Yeah. I keep on writing and writing everything I hear or sometimes imagine. And that's the way it begins. And later, of course, I get through so many books and the testimonies and to confirm the original information I get. But it also comes like a gift. I mean, reality is a very generous woman with me. She's quite generous, lovely. And Perhaps that's why I included so many female stories here, because I think reality is also a woman. I feel she is a woman. And books are growing inside me. I mean, books write me. This is the real story of it. I'm not writing them. They write me. And so at the beginning, it's like something like a lunatic asylum, because stories that have no connection at all, and they do not know where they're going, if they will or not will become a book someday, which book. And from time on, slowly, I'm a slowly person, I go on writing and searching and finding. I find so many stories that deserve to be told, to be contagious enough to go on walking from person to person. Not like a plague exactly, but as a blessing. Because everything that helps us to recover our plenitude, to recover our beauty, to recover our, what I call our human rainbow, which is a very diverse rainbow, and which had been mutilated. Well, all efforts done in this direction is a good effort toward the construction of a different world, which I think is possible.
I'm curious about questions of truth. How important is truth, and is truth a relative thing for you?
It's also always relative, because my truth is not yours, and so on. There are so many truths, possible truths. I'm not speaking about you as a notorious bookworm, but but from the point of view, because each truth, it corresponds to a certain point of view. From the viewpoint of a worm, and a spaghetti dish is an orgy. So, yes. This is a scientific. I mean, this is not imagination. This is scientific, absolutely proved by science. And so it depends on the angle where you're placed. From where are you watching what happens? For instance, last year, 2008, I read in the newspaper an almost unnoticed news, which was about the fact that a man called Nelson Mandela, it sounds, no? I mean, more or less, Nelson Mandela, South Africa, was no more a terrorist. He finished his career as a terrorist in 2008. But during 60 years, he was included in the official list of terrorists in the United States. So each time he went here, he needed a special permission, being as he was a terrorist. And so, is it true? I mean, was he a terrorist? Or we are prisoners of lies? I know that there are so many possible truths, but there are so many lies that competing with our possible truths, I think speaking with you, Michael, today, no? I don't remember that I was taking notes of... I'm always taking notes of something, but...
It's all in his pocket. Everything. Wait till you see.
But this was something I know... In this last week, I don't know where it is. But it was interesting, because I think that we should save the dictionary. It's saved already. But save the dictionary. And writing is perhaps a way to an adventure, trying to recover the true meaning of each word. And so I was writing several words. I think I lost it. It's a pity because it was a very important contribution to human history in this country in the last week, no? During the tour, during the airports. I wrote, mercenaries are called contractors. Torture is called interrogation method. Bribery is called lobbying. And war budget is called defense budget. I was saying this before. So my English is poor, but I guess there is something like an organized system of lies and which was indeed invented in not an exactly innocent way to justify a very unjust social order. And you can see it now, for instance, in this terrible crisis, the entire world is suffering, coming from Wall Street. And so in the newspapers I was reading at that time when it exploded, so many alarming news about the pirates in Somalia, no? Were these have-nots, these hungry, poor people who were assaulting ships. And I began wondering, is it true, is not true? Are they real pirates? Or the real pirates are the bankers of Wall Street who are assaulting the world? It depends on the meaning you give to things. Of course, I understand the situation of all these poor bankers suffering as they are, and I know they deserve to be treated like they are now deserved. They're being, recompensados? Rewarded by their efforts. And it's a sort of... not exactly a Robin Hood policy, but a Hood Robin policy. I mean, stealing to the poor to give to the rich. But their situation is very moving, like a soap opera. I was crying in last September. And I even began a campaign, an international campaign, with no echo at all, no success. The slogan was so moving. It was, adopt a banker.
Yes, one of the people you mentioned as a master, Ambrose Bierce, constructed what he called the Devil's Dictionary, in which he would point out that lobbying and bribery had become synonyms. And it seems to me that part of your work is to assemble the Dictionary of Hell.
Yes, it is, in a certain way. But fortunately enough, it's also open to paradise, because I think we are half marble and half each one of us, no? Half marble, half garbage, and that the world is half hell, half heaven. So when I write, I'm trying always to recover this other side of reality, you know. It always appears, because as I told you before, Michael, we were talking, that reality was this generous woman. It always appeared, this southern light, mysterious, secret, coming from nowhere, who knows. I was very sad recently, really very deeply sad. My dog, my old friend, died. And I was very, very sad. And I was walking alone without him in my neighborhood. I walk and walk, I'm a walker. I'm all the time walking and walking. And I was walking in my sadness, in my darkness, when I crossed a little girl who came on the other way, jumping and, you know, joyful, perhaps 2 years old, no more than 2 years, three maximum. And it was such a sight of other reality, suddenly came to help me, and she was stopping their jumping from time to time, 20 meters, 30 meters, and she stopped. And so I was curious about why she was stopping. And then I realized that she stopped to hear birds singing in the trees. And she applauded. She applauded. And then I could go on walking as if my friend was alive.
Now, it seems so natural for you to talk this way. I speak as someone floored to come up with a question in response to a story so beautiful. And shouldn't we pause to appreciate the presence of a perfect storyteller who allowed us to hear the beginning of the story and say, as all storytellers said, what is he talking about? Where is this going to go? And then the story unwinds and reveals a certain kind of perfection that requires an appreciation silence. If the girl applauded the birds, my silence is my response of admiration to your story. Everyone says it. Isabel Allende says you are a great storyteller and, in fact, an unstoppable storyteller, that you can tell stories for hours. Where did you learn to tell stories?
Yes, in my university, who was the cafes in Montevideo. I am a son of the Montevidean cafes. I have no formal education. I mean, I was only 6 years in the primary school, it's called. There, and only 1 year in the secondary school, 6 and 1, 7, that was all. And all my education comes from the cafes. The stories I was hearing in the cafes since I was very, very young. And these anonymous storytellers who had the talent to tell the past in such a way that they could feel it was present time. And this is the mastery in the art of telling, no? To do this magic, I don't know, acrobacy, in such a way that something happening, I don't know, 2 centuries or 2 millenniums ago, may be told in such a way that you feel now the noise of the rain falling, and you can see the faces of people. And that was all learned in the cafes, and also reading. I mean, My master was, in this sense, not only, I had several, but not only Mark Twain or Beers or Onetti or Rulfo, but also a woman called Sherezade. I learned a lot from her, because you know the story, everybody knows. The most beautiful book, storytelling book ever written. It was written in Baghdad also, in Iraq. It's good to remember it because the place of the earth where scripture was invented, it was the art of writing was not invented in Texas, it was invented in Iraq. And so there also happened the stories that Sherezade told in this marvelous book, The 1001 Tales. No? And the fact is that she was exchanging one story for each new day of life. Because all the other women before had been murdered at al amanecer, at dawn. At dusk there were virgins, and at dawn there were...
By night he would take them to bed, and in the morning he was already bored and he'd slaughter them.
Yes.
Until Scheherazade.
Yes. And so she sometimes she while she was telling the stories, the light of the moon, in the bed, sometimes she felt something like something blowing in the neck. Air, cold air. Perhaps the king was being bored and she was going to die. So from that came for me, the first commandment in the art of writing, in the art of telling stories. It's forbidden to be boring.
It seems that one of the things that's important, and again, this is something else that no one seems to mention about your work, that while the tone is often tender or satirical or poetic or polemical or historical, many, many tones, there's rarely a picture of Eduardo Galeano. The prose is what we used to call impersonal, not anonymous, but not dedicated to creating the presence of Eduardo Galeano. And I'm very interested because in interviews as well, you prefer to answer questions that the writer can answer, but not intimate questions. Tell me about the need for privacy in writing, because it seems to me to be very important to you.
Yes, I think it's a human right, privacy. And so I preserve my own privacy. And as soon as you become more or less famous or well-known, it's dangerous because this privacy can be invaded and you finish, becoming a subject of scandals or... I don't know. I have nothing to hide, but my life is my own life, and I tell a lot of stories coming from inside and from my inner reality and from the reality I'm getting through each day. So in a certain way, I'm always writing self-biographies, in a certain way, but not in the sense that I will be speaking about my intimate life, because it would be like believing that my intimate life is important, and I don't think it at all. My intimate life is just like any other one's intimate life. And I'm not a full-time optimistic. It depends on the hour. As everybody else, we are all optimistic at 10 o'clock, and at noon we are pessimistic, and at 3 we fell down, and at 6 we recover, and that's the way of being alive in this world. And I am like you all are. No difference at all. Because some people thought, perhaps thinks that being a writer, you have some privilege coming from God or Satan. I don't have any privilege. I'm like anybody else. And except in football, in soccer, because there I am a little more fanatic than everybody else.
There are those... I wanted to ask you this for a long time, and I have the feeling it's cultural. A couple of weeks before my father died, he said to me, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Of course." He said, "You promise you won't be angry?" I said, "Oh, of course I won't be angry." He said, "When my father was young, he was a seamstress. He was a tailor. And he never played ball games with me. And I always swore that when I had a child, I would play ball with the child, with you. And I never did. Are you angry at me?"
Oh, such a question.
Yeah. And I was so surprised. I thought, this is what he's going to ask at the end of his life. I said, "Dad, I was grateful. I mean, I really don't... I really don't like this. I mean, you can barely get me outdoors, but outdoors to play football... I mean,
it's okay, Michael.
But tell me what it is,
the answer that Winston Churchill gave to a journalist from the Times He was almost 90 years old, and he was like an apple, you know, so healthy. And Winston Churchill received the Journalist of the Times, and the Journalist of the Times asked him, can you tell me the secret? How are you so good-looking and healthy and with your age and your problems in your life? How is it possible? You must have a secret. And Winston Churchill answered, yes, I have. Sports, I never practiced them. That's exactly
the same. But you love them, and it's a cultural, you know, it's part of your... I want to hear about the adoration of soccer, and I want the implicit question to be why.
Well, I'm not exceptional in this sense, because all Uruguayan babies are born crying, goal, goal, goal. Yes, it's the first... our first word. And so that's why las maternidades, how is it, the places, the hospital for maternities, the maternities, are so noisy, no? Because of all the babies, wow, goal, goal, goal. And I also cried goal, and I, of course, I wanted to be a soccer player when I was a child. But my legs were not good enough. I had wooden legs. I was ashamed of my country. And so I couldn't realize my vocation. And later I tried to be... I was very mystical when I was also a child. I had a tendency to mysticism. At once with football, it was a mixing of different religions. Catholic and football. I also tried to become a saint, but my... my natural tendency to sin was not was in contradiction with this intention. And so I failed. And later I wanted to become a painter. And the results were always far, far away from my intentions. The distance opened between the desires and the world, the desire and reality was so deep and so long that no way. So I became a writer. It's the only thing I more or less can do. I don't even know how to drive a car. I'm really a totally disabled person. Yes, really.
Yo también. Sí.
Yeah, we are brothers.
I don't drive either. I don't know how to. But Grace Paley, who's a writer that I like very much, she said, everyone said I should be a film editor, but really, I'll tell you the truth, I'm afraid of the dark. Writing was the only thing I knew how to do, and the stories of men and women.
I'm a failure, totally a failure.
Totally a failure. Now, yeah. I want to close
when
by...
when I push a bottom at home, and light suddenly happens. I think it's a miracle.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm absolutely unable to arrange, arreglar un enchufe, esas cosas que hacen los hombres. No caso, no. No idea. Can you imagine an absent-minded like I am? Each morning I glue my head to the body because I'm sure that I will forget my head in the cafe or in some place. An absolutely absent-minded. Can you imagine I driving in Uruguay? Uruguay has almost no population. I should kill the last Uruguayans. The last Uruguayans free and alive in the streets. It would be a danger. Fortunately enough, I don't know how to drive. I don't have an identity because this is... United States is a strange place in which cars gives identity to persons. It's the driver's license, no? The driver's license is the document of identity here. I would never have an identity here.
I wanted to end by giving you a gift of a piece of information that I think you will like. You say in the book Mirrors that to your knowledge, no one laughs in the Bible. But to mine, there is one laugh in the Bible. It's Sarah, the wife of Abraham, And why does she laugh? It's perfect that it's a woman who laughs in the Bible. She laughs because an angel comes to her and tells her that she's going to have a baby. And she laughs because she's 600 years old.
I should laugh also. 600 years. My God. And Noah had 900 years. Was 900 years old.
So it's she incredible. Was a spring chicken.
We are all so young. No? We are all babies here in this room. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.